Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman, co-owner and co-chef of Samisa Restaurant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Each week on The Line, I invite a chef, a restaurateur, or a food business owner to come have a one-on-one chat with me to discuss the trajectory of their career. What we all want to know when we see a chef or a business owner is, how did that person get from point A to point B? What decisions did that person make that impacted the course of their career and their life? Was it a first job? Was it cooking with grandma? Or was it a fluke chance meeting with another chef or cooking person that led them down the career path to come to become who they are today? So today we're talking with Claire Welly. She was born outside of Baltimore and she attended the Culinary Institute of America. She's cooked in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., and some of the best kitchens here in New York. And she now leads the kitchen at Otway, which is in Clinton Hill. Claire, thanks for being here.
Good afternoon.
So let's begin by talking about the short-lived but really wonderful Tilde All Day. How did that project come to be? How did you get involved?
Samantha Safer and I have known each other for a few years now. We worked at a really small specialty goods store. I was coming off of a really, really bad job. I weighed like 98 pounds, and like that specialty goods store was basically my rehab for a few months. So we met, and we just stayed in touch. She's always wanted to open up a restaurant, own something. And so one day I got the call. That's it.
And so when you got that call, did she say, I'm doing an all-day cafe, it's going to be here, do you want to be the chef? Or was it like blank slate and you were collaborating? Like, how much were you involved in that process?
She knew that, you know, we wanted an all-day concept. The neighborhood needed something where, you know, there was bread, there was caffeine, there was alcohol. It was really lacking in that moment in time in Clinton Hill. So it was kind of a blank slate. We could create what we wanted. We were the bosses. We didn't answer to anybody. And so we just kind of came up with this great concept of like all day food, no fuss, really approachable, but like great technique.
Tilde's was a beautiful space. It was a wonderful place. Yeah. It had a lot of amazing light.
Yeah.
And you were doing very interesting things there that I hope were making you happy after that unfortunate yeah. Previous job. But Tilde's didn't last.
No.
Sam and your other partner at that time, Daniel, they did end up in court. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I know it's been covered a little bit, but I am curious about your perspective. What happened that forced you to have to leave the project, and what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, I mean, Tilde was a really great moment in time. I'm still very proud of what we got to accomplish there. The people that I got to meet, the foundations that were laid, you know, but working with small business owners and creative people, you know, personalities clash, and that's all it was. It was like when you find a restaurant owner or when you go trail at a restaurant, it's like just going on a date, you know, and the chemistry just wasn't there. So pretty simple, pretty drama free. Yeah, we went to court, but like it's, you know, they were business partners, and that's just what has to happen when you break up.
So when Tilde ceased to exist, in between Tilde and Otway, did you do anything to recharge? Like, what? How did you spend your time? Because there was a how long was the gap in between? 6 months?
Maybe 6 months.
About that?
Maybe. No, I didn't. Let's see. Tilde ended sometime in the summer, like right before our year anniversary, and 2 days later, I started going on trails.
Wow.
I'm a working cook. I got to pay rent, you
know?
I still enjoy what I do. I love producing. I love cooking. I am a cook. So I started going on trails, and I was like, okay, where's my next paycheck coming from? And I found this lovely, lovely brand new restaurant in the West Village called King. And it's two Brits, and they're fantastic, Jess, Claire, and then Annie's in the front of the house. And it was fantastic. It was a really great moment for me to just like cook again with people that loved doing it.
So you weren't running the kitchen?
No. Oh, God, no.
So
no.
You came in as like a line cook.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like no ego. Mm-hmm. Like absolutely no ego. And I have to pay the rent, and to enjoy the beautiful anonymity of being a line cook again, like writing my prep list on my C-fold and like drinking out of my pint container and having my shift drink. I love that. So, I wasn't in charge at all. It was great. They had it on lockdown and I just went in and cooked.
That's cool. That actually is fairly rare that would occur, that you would, you know, be in a leadership position and then something happens and then you have to just take on a job, which is, you know, the reality of it. And then you get this new opportunity mm-hmm. to come back to Otway. So how does Sam approach you, and what is that process that sort of takes you from King back into this new old space?
Yeah, I was just kind of starting to get the itch again to do my type of food, which is just French, to be honest with you. Really, like, I guess in its most simplistic form, it's just French. King was Italian, so I learned a lot, but it just didn't feel as natural as I needed it to feel. So I just started thinking about projects and what to do. And Samantha had the space, you know, so we just started talking about concepts and what would make us happy. And we just realized that, like, dinner service, not being open 7 nights a week, not doing lunch, no delivery. We just started talking about the things that we didn't want. And from the things that we didn't want grew the thing that we did want, which was Otway, a place where we could have a great time, have quality of life, put out great food, show technique, be happy, teach. And then, and then just, it was our own. It just became our own.
You made an interesting business decision, so you alluded to the fact, you know, quality of life.
Yeah.
But you also said that Tilda was something that satisfied a void in the neighborhood, in the marketplace, mm-hmm. which was that there wasn't a great place to get really delicious handcrafted pastries and excellent coffee. And in the sort of rebranding of the space, the reopening of it, you moved away from that. Mm-hmm. Was that really hard for you both to say that we really had a success with Tilda from like a customer facing perspective, but internally you guys were, both made a decision, both of you together, that wasn't an ideal anymore.
I live in the neighborhood. I live a half a block away from the restaurant. So I kind of feel like I am also my client. I'm also my guest. And there's a few great places in Clinton Hill to get wine, to get dinner service. But there's always a need for more. And we just filled a niche. Like, our guests, our community has been so gracious in letting us evolve. We've been able to evolve. They've never been like, no, I don't want you to keep doing what you're doing. No, I don't want you to be happy. No, I don't want to see what's next. Like, it was, we kind of set the tone with Tilda, like, let us show you what's next. So it was actually really, really great, the warm welcome from the community.
I'm curious about that. So do you see yourself actually, you're a neighborhood restaurant? Is that how you kind of view yourself?
I mean, I view us as a restaurant that serves dinner. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds so simplistic and just so, I don't know. It just, we serve dinner. Like, that's what we do. We do dinner. Mm-hmm. If we fill in a niche in the neighborhood, if we're a destination restaurant, because we are in Clinton Hill and it's hard to get to, I just don't like to, I don't know. I don't like to be pigeonholed.
I want to talk a little bit about pigeonholing. I'm interested. That's funny that you said that word. You lead me to my next question, which is the Gothamist article about the relaunch of Otway had mm-hmm. this line in it. Samantha Safer and Claire Welle have tapped an all-female team to run the kitchen. Someday this will just be normal and awesome, but until that day, it's noteworthy. The Village Voice review referenced your all-female kitchen as well. Yeah. Pretty much every single article that I found on you while I was doing research for this references the all-female kitchen. And now, here I am, a guy, asking you about it as well. So what are your thoughts on this as sort of like fetishization of like an all-female kitchen?
Yeah.
I'm curious if you're at all happy that it's being called out. And I want to ask you, are you annoyed that it's newsworthy? Like, can you unpack this a little bit and how it makes you feel?
How it makes me feel. My emotions. Okay, so I'm grateful for any press that our small restaurant gets. So no, I don't get upset about it. However, I do now approach it with like, okay, yes, it is an all female kitchen, but can you think of something else to talk about? Like, give me something else. Give me a different point of view. Let's have a different conversation.
Right.
In the restaurant business, it doesn't matter. Male, female, black, white, it doesn't matter. If you can hold down on a Saturday night and put the food up at the same time as your station partner, it doesn't matter what you are. And so for years, I never had to think, oh, I'm a female, I'm a woman cook. I was just another one of the cooks on the line. So I don't think about it. But when it came to Otway, we had this like very specific concept, these very like high standards, these details that we wanted to achieve. And when we put that out there, when we put that level of care out there into the world, it attracted a very certain type of cook. And it attracted like all of the people that I've cooked with in my like previous lives. And we're all friends. Yes, we all happen to be women, but it was just more about the standards.
There's this obsessiveness of food media to create lists and to then put people on lists. So it's like, you know, Cheap Eats, best restaurant on Fulton Street, open only for dinner. You know,
like
there's all these ways that you have to fit into those grooves. And I hear what you're saying about sort of like playing the game and also, you know, you want the press.
Absolutely.
You know, it helps the restaurant in the end, right? We need paychecks. We need to pay our staff.
Turns out money's a thing.
We need to keep the lights on, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm curious though, like in terms of menus, it doesn't really seem like you are playing the game, because I love your menu construction, and also it reads in a way that I don't find traditional.
Yeah.
And so for the listeners at home, just in case you're driving or something, I want to talk about a couple of the things on the menu that I think are really cool. So there are, the construction and contents are unique because they're like juxtaposed with like a crowd pleaser, but then not. So I guess what I'm saying is like the gem lettuce salad is something that I don't mean to like denigrate it in any way, but
absolutely
it's definitely
not
something that people come in and they can wrap their heads around. But then
salad,
you sort of go down the list a little bit and it's like you've got duck, not everyone's favorite thing. You've got a smoked tongue.
Yeah.
I'd say that's very out there for anywhere, any restaurant. And then the pork has blood sauce on it.
Absolutely.
So,
of course.
To me as an eater, I'm sure for you as a cook, like this is awesome. You get to play around with the stuff that you want. I'm curious, like, do you on purpose right now not have a chicken and a steak on the menu? Is that intentional in any way?
I'll never have chicken on the menu.
Cool. So tell me about like what do you do with the menu? How do you build your menu and what makes it on and what doesn't make it on?
Okay. So this is, you just opened up like, okay, so you have to inspire your cooks, right? You have to bring talent to your restaurant. And by having a menu that never changes, by having chicken, by having, you know, a fish that nobody likes to work with, you're going to only attract a very specific type of cook. So it's 50-50. 50% of me has to please my guests, and then 50% of me has to please my staff. We have to teach. We have to keep it fun. We have to be motivated. We have to work with the seasons. Like it just so happens in the last couple of weeks, we've been able to put rhubarb and asparagus, but for 3 months it was rutabaga. So you have to inspire. And then two, I just like to cook this style of food. And yes, it doesn't appeal to everybody, but actually this menu is a lot more approachable than our opening menu. We had tripe on there. We had sweetbreads on there. We had something else that was like, oh my God. Anyway, but I like to work with these ingredients. They're delicious. They require a lot of technique. Like offals just require very specific technique for this specific type of cut. It keeps it interesting. And I like the response when people are like, wow, I didn't think I liked that, and now I like it, because they maybe hadn't had it done well. Think about having chicken livers, like just cooked to shit. Oh, sorry. Can I say?
Yeah.
Okay. Just totally cooked to shit. And then you think, oh, I don't like that. And then when you finally have it done well, you're like, oh my God, I like this. I'm going to eat it for the rest of my life. Like to see that moment is great.
It's cool that you're kind of going for, what you want and what your staff wants, and then you're like almost secondary hoping to educate your customer into that.
It's such a fine line.
So that is a fine line. How do you and Samantha and the and your front of house staff, and I don't know if your cooks bring up food and touch tables there.
Oh, but absolutely.
So the interaction between your staff and the customer, you are in an area where there is a ton of foot traffic, and I would assume that some people come in for dinner and they don't even look at the menu and then they sit down and they might be looking for, you know, they might be looking for that steak frites or whatever, which you're probably not going to ever have on the menu.
No.
So what is that kind of communication and education process like in Otway to convey what you are thinking in your head and what's going on in the back kitchen so that what ends up on the plate doesn't seem so foreign to the customer?
So we don't approach it ever by thinking about educating our guests. We are like, we have a philosophy, we have a concept, and we have a menu, yes, but it's never like, okay, let's educate them and then they'll understand the food and then they'll enjoy it because they know about. No, it's not. We really try hard to not do that. Education of guests is like not a sentence in our kitchen, in our restaurant. We just think about like what we want to do. We trust our instincts and we just try to have a really great time with it. And like, quality and consistency. Those are the two like words that we use a lot. I think if you have a quality product, it's going to speak for itself. And if you can deliver it on a consistent basis, then you're going to win people over.
Before we went on air, you mentioned that today is your day off and that the restaurant is closed today.
Yeah.
That's amazing. It's not something that you always find in restaurants. And there is this work-life balance that people are always trying to achieve. And obviously, you've made the decision to be closed for one day a week, which gives everyone a much needed breather. Of course, when you look at the monetization of a seat and you talk about a service, so now you've gone from like an all day cafe open 7 days a week, breakfast, lunch, dinner. We're going to, you know,
crushing it.
We're going to do coffee now. We're going to do pastries here. We got a sandwich there. And now really you've got 6 nights a week to do dinner.
Right.
So there's that work-life balance, but there's also, are you looking at the bottom line and what are the thoughts there with Samantha, your partner?
Yeah.
And how much of that kind of business decision plays into your daily life?
Yeah, I think Samantha and I got really lucky with one another. She is fantastic with numbers. She lets me do whatever I want. And so I don't take advantage of that. We don't waste a single thing in our restaurant. We compost everything we can possibly compost. We create like 3 bags of garbage a week. We recycle. We have family meal that utilizes everything. We are pickling everything down to dill stems and then juicing the parsley stems for the bar. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no waste. Food cost is low, so it means I can pay my cooks a little bit more. And yeah, we're an independent restaurant. Margins are really, really, really small, but we've figured out what's important to us and we're doing our best to make all of those things come true. And so I didn't get into this business to be a millionaire. If I did, then I would be a totally different cook. I'd be in a totally different restaurant. So we know what's important and we're focusing on that and we're making that happen.
I'm curious about your leadership style in the kitchen and you're working with cooks. You've many times now described it as teaching and collaborative and, you know, working together. Do cooks put things on the menu ever? How does that work? How does that process work in your kitchen?
Absolutely.
How does a dish come to be at Otway?
Yeah. Okay. So it's definitely a collaboration. I kind of am like, I will give them the end game. And then we will all take our personalities and our memories and our likes and our dislikes and our palate and bring all of that to the table. We've been working on this dish for the last couple of weeks. And I'm like saying weeks because I keep going back to the drawing board with it. Like, I had it in my head, raw beef sandwich. And that's like all like raw beef sandwich. And we went through maybe 3 or 4 different variations of this raw beef sandwich until we finally got to the right one. And we just keep on going back to the drawing board until everybody's happy because they have to pick up the food. And if they don't like it, the food's not going to taste great. So it is a collaboration. Yes, I kind of lead them down the path of like, okay, this is our concept. This is what we are. This is who we are. Now have fun with it. And of course, seasons. So it's definitely a collaboration. And, you know, leadership style, you have to let people be creative. For years and years and years, like, cooks are just kept down and kept down and kept down. Don't think about anything. Don't be different. Don't stand out. Make the food exactly how I want it to be made. And then all of a sudden they're like sous chef and they have no idea how to do anything. So when I teach a cook something, I honestly don't think to myself, man, I'm going to benefit from this. I think if I can teach them how to make mayonnaise, if I can teach them how to emulsify something, if I can teach them how to get through a great service, then they're going to succeed at their next job. Their next boss is going to be like, man, they really know what they're doing. They're a good cook. And that's what's important to me.
I like the look on a cook's face when you teach them how to do something and they do it properly.
Oh my God.
And then they realize that they don't need you next time they do it. I don't have kids, but I imagine it's like when you release the back of the bicycle.
Produce tears, I would probably cry. I love it so much.
There's this really cool moment when they can see what, like, making it, when emulsifying something properly, yeah, and when, you know, a sauce doesn't break, and they realize, wow, there's a cool scientific process that happened that I don't really understand, but also now I have something in my repertoire,
you know?
And that's a very,
it's amazing.
That's a very cool moment. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to be back with more with Claire, and we're going to talk a little bit about how you came to get involved in cooking. Stick with us here on Heritage Radio Network.
Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back to The Line. We're here with Claire Welly from Otway. She was previously the chef of Tilda All Day, which was in the same space. It took a brief hiatus and then reopened as a dinner-only restaurant where she is now leading the kitchen along with her partner Samantha, who she was also partners with at Tilda. So, Claire, I wanted to ask you about baking.
Yeah.
When Tilda launched, there was a pastry program, I guess that's what you'd call it, and you were getting a lot of great acclaim for a lot of pastries that you were doing.
Yeah.
I'm curious, are there any that you really loved that stick out in your mind as sort of like a favorite, and has anything carried over to Otway, or did you sort of reinvent every baked good that you're using now?
I was really proud of what we accomplished at Tilda when it came to the pastries. I had an amazing assistant. Her name's Allison Young. And so together we were the pastry program, but I am not a baker. I am not a pastry cook. I'm actually terrible at it. At least I think so. I happen to be okay at it, but I don't love doing it. So when we opened Otway, people would, you know, oh, are you going to have this? Are you going to have this? And I made it very clear from the beginning, no, if it was done at Tilda, if we did it at Tilda, if we tried it at Tilda, if you ate it at Tilda, you would never, I'm sorry. Thank you so much for liking it, but you're never going to have it again.
So people wanted, people were coming in asking like for the pistachio.
Still. Yeah. Like I dropped bread last week and somebody was like, oh man, I wish that was the morning bun. And I was like,
try the new stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, guys, like if you really loved that, just wait, you know, just wait. And so I think we did kind of build a really great reputation with just like the fact that we would have quality products. So just trust us to make something great.
So you brought a loaf of bread. I'm staring at it right now.
Brought a loaf of bread.
Tell me about it. Yeah. Tell me about the baking and fermentation process that, so you have a, everyone gets bread at the table when they come
everybody
in for
gets bread.
Cool. Like, so tell us a little about the bread. Why do you do it that way and how do you do your bread?
Okay. So, I mean, you know, you talked about how like Tilda filled a niche. It had coffee, it had pastries. Yes. But also like in our community in Clinton Hill, there is no bread. There's no bread. And so we knew that it was definitely something that we wanted to do. I want the cooks to be able to learn bread and take that to their next restaurant. If they needed to create bread for their dinner service, they're going to be able to do it now. So it's a naturally leavened bread. I'm Norwegian, so of course it's going to have rye and caraway and everything in there. So it is. It's a naturally leavened 72-hour process, and we're just really proud of it. It's a really high hydration dough, and we don't have a deck oven. We don't have a proofing box. We have literally like a bus tub. We have an oven that doesn't work that we use as a proofing box, and then we have Banneton molds, and that's just what, like, we created a product in kind of an environment that you don't think should have a product like this.
So you, what's the bake for that style of bread? Like, is it what temperature? And
yeah. So it's, since it's a really high hydration, it's like 495 degrees Fahrenheit for 38 minutes. So it's like very, very, very hydrated, but we're able to, at such a high temperature, at least create a great crust.
So it doesn't get sprayed with water or anything to develop the crust?
We do spray it a little bit with water. We do spray the oven when it goes in there to help with, you know, oven spraying. But because we are using it the same day and it doesn't sit in plastic wrap, because plastic wrap kills crust, it has such a nice natural, like crunchy, crunchy, flaky. We have to decrumb the tables like four times a night. So
everyone gets that on,
everybody gets bread
on their table.
I believe in
that's
getting
a,
bread.
That's
sorry.
A nice way to start
I'm
off
I'm not going
to
charge you $6 for bread. I'll make the cost up somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I won't throw something away. I'll reuse a product. If it means that our guests are going to get bread, like bread for free, that's good. At least I think so. Then I'm going to do it.
I want to take you back to your childhood in Baltimore.
Okay.
I want to hear a little bit about what it was like growing up. And do you remember a moment when you first got interested in food?
Yeah.
When was that?
I grew up outside of Baltimore in a really, really small farming community. And you're basically told at a really young age in our public school system, what are you going to do? Pick your career. And then all of your classes for the rest of your middle school, high school life is geared towards that profession.
Sounds like a smart way to learn.
I guess so. I guess it's like very French, but at the same time, it's just very like, you have to pick something.
Make a choice.
Yeah, make a choice. And it's usually like nursing or teaching or, you know, farming.
Yeah.
And I picked cook. I picked cook at 14. I don't know why I knew I wanted to do it. I did grow up in a household with like my mom having dinner on the table all the time, big Sunday breakfasts. She always loved cooking, was always into it. My dad used to take me to the grocery store and send me into the produce and was like, pick whatever you want. He's like, what haven't you tried yet? Pick something.
Cool.
We'd always go out to really nice restaurants. And so I guess my whole childhood was kind of geared towards it. And then the fact that I just really love to work. I love to be disciplined. I don't know if it's my ADD that needs to be under control or something, but I need the rigor of a kitchen. So at 14, I picked cook.
So at 14, you make this choice.
Yeah.
And did you pick up a job somewhere?
I was a dishwasher.
Where at?
At a country club. At a golf course country club with a buffet. you know,
where all the greats start. Big country club.
Oh gosh, big smiles, thin slices, baby. Like absolutely. So I remember making cantaloupe swans and prime rib on Sundays, and I did the waffle station, and I made omelets for people with a big toque on. My sous chef was having sex with somebody in the walk-in. It was awful, but I loved every. I remember my first. I got my first burn there. Yeah, country club, golf course.
So how do you end up at the CIA?
How do I end up at the CIA? My parents said, Claire, you need some sort of higher education. Because I don't think, for years, I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. And all of a sudden, I go to my mom one day, and I'm like, no, Mom, I want to be a cook. And the look on her face. So
no.
Exactly. So I think they didn't know if it would stick. So they told me that I needed some sort of higher education. Even though the CIA is a culinary school, I still walked away with an associate's degree. Mm-hmm. So I went there instead of going straight into the workforce, which I wanted to. I was going to stay for bachelor's, but then I just saw how unneeded it was. Sorry, CIA. It's not needed. And so I just went right into the kitchen.
So where's your first job after you get out of the CIA?
First job out of CIA.
Was it at Moss or no?
First job out of CIA. No. Okay. So first job out of CIA, I met my significant other at culinary school. He's also a cook. And I was going to go to Alinea. I was going to work at a restaurant in Baltimore for a little bit that doesn't exist anymore. And then I was going to go to Alinea. And then I was like, no, I think I need to go be with you in San Francisco. So I moved to San Francisco and I started working at a really great restaurant, which I don't even know. Actually, all of my restaurants that I've ever worked at, don't exist anymore. It's real. I don't know what it is. But it was called The Fifth Floor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Michelin starred restaurant in a hotel. And it was amazing and it was fantastic. And I had a great chef. And I got to move up the stations and work. And it was really nice.
You in New York, you've been at Moss Farmhouse, Gwinnett Street,
yeah.
Rebel.
Yeah.
Which one of those experiences really stands out for you? Is there a certain moment that you can share, or is there sort of a really hard day that you had at one of those places that you think helped
Gwinnett
construct
Street.
Something for you?
Gwinnett Street, and I say that with full confidence, without a doubt. I still talk to my line cook, Michael Lombardi owns a restaurant in Boston, and he is crushing it right now. It's called SVR, I think. And we talk all the time. Dan Harris, my meat cook, was in when I was on Entremet. He was the meat cook, and he's in Chicago crushing it right now. Ayaka Guido is my best friend, and she was Garmo and Entremet, and she's at the sous chef at Little Park. Gwinnett Street was the most beautiful moment in time you could have ever imagined.
The plates that were coming out of Gwinnett were pretty wild.
Yeah, and Justin's so talented.
A lot of things that were happening there were maybe, you could say, a little bit ahead of their time. Also,
yeah, I think so. I agree with you.
Perhaps people were, they thought it was one thing and they thought it was another thing. Did you take any of your plating style? Did you learn things about plating at Gwinnett Street? Because you have very beautiful plates. They're precise, but mm-hmm. they don't look overly precise. And
yeah.
we're on radio, so hopefully everyone can go look
exactly.
at you know, the Instagram and look at some of the plates you put out. But I'm curious about your philosophy of putting things onto a plate.
Mm-hmm.
How precious are you about that process?
Yeah.
And how do you work with your cooks in the kitchen to either mimic your movements or not? Or is there a bit of freedom there?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think either you're a plater or you're not a plater. I've always had chefs that wanted to plate their own food and you could really never touch the food. So I didn't get a lot of hands-on muscle memory when it came to plating. I'm one of those non-platers. I will cook the food, I will put it on a sizzle tray for you, and then I will pass the buck because I'm actually not really great at it. And so we do have a lot of freedom. You can kind of do what you want to do, but it's just, I don't know. It's very natural. I try not to fake it because I feel like as soon as it looks over designed, it looks like you really tried. It's not natural and it's not instinctual. So we just go for how do we get on the plate? Hot food, hot plates. How do we get it out to the guest in a beautiful, timely manner?
That's always something so funny to me. It seems like when the top priority becomes how beautiful the plate is, people forget that someone's got to eat it. And
hot food, hot plates.
It hits your table and you're like, wow, that looks amazing. And
yeah, well, now
my chicken's cold.
Now now nobody's eating the food right away.
Right. There's another 5-10 minute gap of structuring the plate properly.
Oh my God, making the lighting okay and finding like which filter you're going to use for your Instagram post. Just eat the food,
but
people.
Well, you shouldn't have made the lighting in your restaurant so good. Then people wouldn't take so many pictures.
I should turn the lights off.
So beyond that, I'm curious, you know, what are things that you have found in sort of the New York? You worked in New York, D.C., San Francisco, you know, basically the top food cities. I'm curious about if there's anything happening right now, a trend or, you know, any of the movements forward in the New York food scene that you don't enjoy, that you're hoping to get away from or that you hope will end.
Well, we talked like before the break about. We do dinner, like come in, have a snack, have an appetizer, an entree, cheese, and please, dear God, get dessert. Don't go to your bodega. Don't get a pint of ice cream. Get the $9 dessert. Okay. It's worth it. We do dinner. The format of the menu is like very flowing, like come in, get three courses. And so we are trying to give a guest a very specific experience. You've chosen our restaurant to have a specific experience. Please don't come in and try to make it something it's not. And that's the problem with small plates. My segue. That's my problem with small plates. You are giving the guest, the diner, so much power to create their own experience, and then they're going to walk away and they're going to be like, wait, what did I have? When did I have it? Why did I pay $6 for bread? What was that? You know. And so just come in. Forget everything that you've learned about dining in the last 3 years and just come in and have dinner and trust us to do it well.
You spend all your time in the kitchen. Your partner spends all the time in the kitchen. I am curious about how you both can find a little time that's away from the restaurants, and are you able to turn it off? A lot of people that work in this business...
Yeah.
They're good at what they do, and you're probably good at what you do is because, you know, your mind is racing, right? You're always thinking about how to make a plate better, how to make the restaurant better. I'm curious, how do you find that little bit of you time, and how do you turn off the restaurant literally for the day?
I don't turn it off because if you ask me who I am and what I do, I am a cook. It's who I am. It's not just what I do. I still write lists. If I leave something at my house, I get so angry that I have to turn around. I FIFO my fridge. Like, it's just, I am a cook. So you don't turn it off. You just learn what's important and when it's important. Like, can that call wait? Can that dish wait? You know, today is my day off and I'm going to spend it with Patrick and things can wait. You know, I've realized that in the last couple of years. Things can wait.
When you're not at your restaurant, when you're not at his restaurant, is there somewhere where you both like to go together? Somewhere in Brooklyn, in Manhattan, it doesn't even need to be in New York, that you found has been a really memorable, wonderful dining experience for you?
We love Oscar. We love, I mean, like, I'm Scandinavian. We love going to Edna Bar and sitting in the basement surrounded by exposed wooden beams and sheepskin and, like, just drinking amazing wine. It's so relaxing. It's so wonderful. We go to Reynard all the time because we have a whole bunch of friends that work there and they treat us so well. So right now, like, because we're around food all the time, wine is kind of very interesting to us. That's a new frontier. It's something else to learn. So anywhere where there's really great wine, you'll find us.
What's something that you're drinking right now that's really got you excited? Do you do natural wines?
Yeah, everything.
Okay.
Although I am a bit of a Francophile, but like, I don't know. I had a really amazing Aligoté last night. It's just like the workhorse grape of Burgundy. And so for me, it was just, I love it. It was crisp, it was clean, it was mineral, but it was like a little foggy and had like really nice natural sediment. Just anything. Ciders right now, like talk about a great shift drink. Like give me a New York cider. Give me a Basque cider. So Yeah, it's like the new frontier. All the cooks, we do all of the wine tastings together. That entire wine list is a complete collaboration. No longer are you just watching your owner drink alone in the dining room with a wine purveyor. Like, we are out there, we are doing it, we are experiencing it, because I want them to have that knowledge of wine.
How much do you let the wine be a sort of a driving force into the seasonality of the dishes and of the restaurant?
It has to be. It has to be, because there people go to restaurants for very different reasons. It's not just all about the food. If you ask me what the most important thing is at Otway, it's the service, hands down. The food takes a back seat, and I'm saying that as the person that creates the food. The wine mirrors the food just so well, at least in my opinion, because we pick really high acid, very enjoyable, approachable wines. So it really helps with the complete experience.
You say you're a planner, you make lists.
Yeah.
I'm curious, how far ahead do you think about Otway? How far ahead do you think about you, where you might be? Do you have a thought on where a year from now, 5 years from now, you may be in the context either of Otway or maybe not even New York City?
It's still so young. It's so infantile that I can't think about it quite yet. Like, what I'm thinking about right now is what I'm going to do with zucchini. You know, like, I have to change my large format dessert this week, and I made rice pudding yesterday, and it was terrible. And I realized that I can't make rice pudding, and I don't know how to make rice pudding, so now I have to think about something else. So, no, I mean, one of my cooks is going to have dental surgery on Friday, and I'm thinking about that because I want her to be okay. It's not about me.
Tell everyone where they can find the restaurant.
It's in Clinton Hill. It's off of Fulton, two blocks down from the methadone clinic.
Claire, thank you so much for joining me here on the line.
It's been my pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Everyone, please go and check out the restaurant. Join us here on Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday at 11 a.m. for a new episode of The Line.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.